retrogrades.
How to re-evangelize the de-Christianized West.
Support us in any way you can, most especially by your prayers.
From an authentically Catholic perspective.
Right-minded, righteous group that's equal in strength to the radicals.
From an authentically masculine perspective.
You and your friends versus me and my friends. Bring it on.
Good morning, everybody. Welcome to Rules for Retrogrades number 27. And today I'm here with Tim, of course. Wave to the camera, Tim. Today we're going to be talking about something that actually doesn't get much airtime. It doesn't get much treatment in apologetics books. It doesn't get much treatment really out there in the Catholic blogosphere whatsoever. And it's troublesome because this is a theme that we run into all the time in family life. So I think somebody has needed to treat with vigor and dispatch the issue of the fourth commandment and what exactly it entails, because there's a lot of confusion out there from, you know, there are some people, of course, and this is a societal bane, that there's a rebelliousness and disdain for authority that is kind of rampant in society, especially as we're raising a more lawless and illicit younger generation, without the etiquette and manners that kind of held society together, that acted as its glue for many, many years before. Those things have been lost quickly after the societal revolution of the 60s. But also because there is a tendency for parents of this age, but of all ages, to kind of abuse their station of authority and to demand almost a godlike obedience even from their adult kids. And that's not quite healthy, and oftentimes they mask their unhealthy and really maybe hurtful demeanors in the fourth commandment, the honor thy father and thy mother. So what exactly does honoring thy father and thy mother entail? And that's what we're going to talk about today. It's a most fraught and understood topic. Many, even in Orthodox circles, have strongly paternalistic tendencies, essentially worshipfully doing their parents' bidding without regard for their duty to cleave from their parents in adulthood. And when parents are dysfunctional, as many unfortunately are in today's day and age, this becomes more of a problem. And there's just little sound guidance out there, so to help people navigate this line between obsequity for father and mother and dishonoring father and mother. So finding the right balance is essential for family life and good of the soul, and that's what we're going to help do today. What do you think, Tim?
Well, remember Benedict the 16th, right before he absconded, he called this the age of the absconding fathers, and this makes all the difference. What I mean is, everywhere around us, the concept of fatherhood is misunderstood. It's partly been perverted and hijacked by feminism, which we deal with in our book. Partly, it's the scourge of modernism, beginning with Protestantism, which really taught all of society, to the extent that it was Protestantized, that the family is just a worldly thing, that marriage is not a sacrament. And so fatherhood, and to some extent motherhood, but fatherhood is widely misunderstood. This brings to mind the idea of Cardinal Cafaro's, one of his last speeches in 2017, I think May of 2017, before he died, like 4 months. He says that he reminded us that Sister Lucia of Fatima had written him a letter in the 90s saying the last attack would be on the family. People often think this means homosexual marriage, which it does. It's evil, it's wicked, vile, disgusting, etc. But what affects far more households, to the tune of 100 times more, is when Papa is not in charge of the kids, they'll squabble, they feel unloved or underloved, it makes them competitive, and it leads to grown-up adult infighting between siblings. I mean, some of which is natural, but the level to which we're seeing this now, people write me about it, I have friends, I all around in society. It's infighting between brother and sister. People talk like they don't even love their families. And we say, yes, this is a problem. In traditional-minded circles, a lot of times there's an overcompensation to the lawlessness or the anarchy that Dave mentioned after, you know, the last 70 years where the father is essentially being toppled. And so they just talk about the Fourth Commandment like it means everything, even after someone's attained their majority. There's discontent resultantly and family strife everywhere. And we thought we'd tackle this topic. What do you do? What does Jesus say to do, for instance, in the Gospels, when your family can't get along? And, you know, first off, why isn't it getting along? So, yeah, there's a lot here. Family of origin issues, as I think Dr. Ray Grandy calls them.
Right. And there is. There's this, it's like a bimodal distribution of families in today's society, where you have the broken families who are essentially, you know, maybe fatherless or motherless in a case of divorce. And so you have that over here, the broken family. And then over here, you've got families that have stayed together and maybe have strong faith and are tight-knit and have navigated many of the perils of lawlessness of the current culture. But at the same time, they are, again, strongly paternalistic, and it's almost like this failure to cleave, as the Bible commands, grown adult offspring from the family. Or, you know, there's a central figure, and sometimes, a lot of times today, it's actually the mother. We kind of live in a maternalistic and matriarchal society, a disordered society because of feminism. So sometimes, yeah, whether it's a mama's boy, like kind of doing his mother's behest, even at the expense of his own family, whether it's, you know, unnaturally keeping himself in constrained to a particular job market. You'll hear about this a lot, like a husband who's out of work who won't do a nationwide search for work because he thinks it's his duty to... And there might be a legitimate time where your parents, yeah, are ill or infirm, and we're going to get into that, where you have a duty to take care of them. You know, some moralists even say abstaining from the priesthood to take care of an ill or infirm parent is a good thing. But that's an exception. But it's abused a lot where people try and stay local to be around mother and father because there's this failure to cleave. And so there's lots of problems, whether it's just taking orders on too daily of a basis, even after the duty of obedience is ended.
And the ironic part here is you hear in Protestant circles, like leave and cleave being taught. They at least, like so many problems in society, the problems were largely crafted by Protestantism and the Enlightenment. And at the same time, faithful Protestant circles, more conservative Protestant circles, kind of, although they created the problems, they deal with them. You never hear leave and cleave dealt with in Catholic circles. If an adult...
Yeah, trads, no.
Trads or even, you know, whatever, Novus Ordo Catholic, in any group of Catholicism, right? If you hear a family that's in turmoil, what do they say? They get recourse to the Fourth Commandment, right?
Fourth Amendment, no searches and seizures.
Yeah,
don't do that.
No, I mean, yeah, it's like, I don't know, I've spoken to at least three people over the last 3 years that were locked in family conflict. And they're like, well, I guess I just honor thy father and thy mother.
Right.
This means that ultimately I can kind of push back a little more after I'm 18. But my dad's not really Catholic. I mean, he kind of just went to church because of my mom. This is what everyone says, because this is what pretty much everyone out there is dealing with. 95% of Catholics. So my dad wants me to do something that's either not Catholic, it squarely conflicts with the faith, or he just wants me to do something that I don't think is so sensible. And they simply don't have the tools to combat the common misconception of what the Fourth Commandment calls us to. It does not call you to obedience when you're a grown man with your own family. This could never work.
Right.
So we want to clarify.
That's having two heads. That's a household having two heads. The father is the head of the household, not the grandfather. Not the grandmother. I suppose that's worth saying, unfortunately, in today's society. Okay, so just quickly then, let's go into the Fourth Commandment a little bit. What does it command? What doesn't it command? In terms of, because it goes both ways, by the way. The fourth commandment not only binds children to duties to their parents, but it also binds, and the church has always seen it this way, parents to their children and gives them duties to their children.
See, that's another point you don't hear.
No, you don't. You really don't. It's a breach of the fourth commandment when parents fail to, like, for instance, catechize their kids. And we're going to get into that. So I'm going to read a brief bit from the Catechism of Trent, which summarizes, I think, best, and then we can get into more into the weeds of what the fourth commandment says. But I think a good summary is found in the Catechism of Trent. Manner of honoring parents. The honor which children are commanded to pay to their parents should be the spontaneous offering of sincere and dutiful love. This is nothing more than their due, since their love for us, since for love of us, they shrink from no labor, no exertion, no danger. Their highest pleasure is to feel that they are loved by their children, the dearest objects of their affection. So I think there's the, and in both cases, you're going to see there's this primary duty of love. Now, all of the moralists see in this duty of love a threefold obligation. So that's number one is to love, number two is to reverence, and number three is to obey. And of course, at the age of majority, this duty to obey disappears. So really, I think everyone has love and affect and effect for parents naturally. We are predisposed to love our parents. Reverence, I think, is the real sticking point. And that reverence needs to be in word, deed, and sign. So when you see a bunch of filial piety exuding from somebody, it's really this reverence that we're seeing. And when you see somebody who is rebellious and is not really doing their part for the fourth commandment, it's generally a lack of reverence or obedience. But the way that, of course, the adult children may run afoul of the fourth commandment will be more in terms of the reverence that's owed to their parents.
Yeah, but here's the problem. Right. This is that we don't want to do what we're what we want to treat the overlooked gap. We want to treat the overlooked problem. What about when what are the case of the real life Pap Finn, right, from, you know, Huckleberry Finn's dad? That's an end member, an extreme member. He's a murderer, we find out at the end of the novel, right? He tells Huck not to go to church. He tells Huck not to go to school. It's slightly extreme, but it's not the Pap Finn hypothetical is not unrepresentative for the fatherless age or the age of absconding fathers, the crisis of fatherhood, where most mothers are the ones, if any, in families enforcing churchfulness. Fathers are usually either staying home at watching football on Sundays or kind of begrudgingly going and then complaining about all the rules after.
Right.
So how does one reverence one's parents, particularly one's father, when in this era, when it's difficult to do, because all we can really extol, this is, you know, the moral implications of the analogy of being, all we can really extol is virtue in this life. The good. It's one angle or another of the good. You sure can't. And so people get into problems of like, oh, I should look like I'm reverencing my father or revering my father even when he's doing wrong. And maybe he's doing wrong or commanding others to do wrong much of the time. What it boils down to, and this is going to be, you know, shake things up in adulthood. I'll say this right from the beginning. I don't want to throw you off kilter, but what it most boils down to, in my view, and in I've found some church teachings that echo this, is caring for your parents. Even if your dad's a godless, calloused, grumpy old man that you know curses everyone that walks in the room, to use an extreme example. It's easier to use these extreme examples, and then you guys can back calculate to less extreme examples in real life. What are you responsible for doing? Well, you're responsible in most cases for caring for elderly parents, right? I found a long time ago Thomas Aquinas saying care, you know, it's like the Benjamin Button of real life. Parents care for young when they're young, and young the young adults care for their parents in infirmity. It's the cycle of life. This is the best way to revere your parents in their old age. It has nothing to do with obedience, and it has nothing to do with saying, you know, well, my dad yells at me that Hiroshima and Nagasaki were the greatest, you know, things ever. Well, we're not allowed to cheer for acts of utilitarianism as Catholics. So what do I do? You know, well, I don't revere that. I simply say, well, you're wrong, Dad, but agree to disagree. Show respect and continue caring for him, right? Letting him live in your home when he's too old to care for himself.
Right.
Well, it's structural stuff.
There's certainly a component, and again, the Catechism of Trent speaks to this. We honor our parents when we relieve their necessities, supplying them with necessary food and clothing, according to the words of Christ, who, reproving the impiety of the Pharisees, said, "Why do you also transgress the commandments of God because of your traditions? For God said, honor thy father and thy mother, and he that shall curse father or mother, let him die the death. But you say, whoever shall say to his father or mother, the gift whatsoever proceedeth from me shall profit thee, and he shall not honor his father or mother, and you have made void the commandment of God for your tradition. But if at all times it is our duty to honor our parents, this duty becomes still more imperative when they are visited by severe illness. We should then see to it that they do not neglect confession and the other sacraments, which every Christian should receive at the approach of death. We should also see that pious and religious persons visit them frequently to strengthen their weakness, assist them by their counsel, and animate them to the hope of immortality, that having risen above the concerns of this world, they may fix their thoughts entirely on God." So there is this, certainly, a necessity there to care for the needs of parents bodily, in old age, in infirmity, but also of soul. You know, it's a weird paradox that in today's world, you see a lot of people who are obsequiously obedient in adulthood to their parents, but then when their parents are on their deathbed, they're afraid to be telling them to convert because they know their father's been out of the church for the last 50 years, and he's divorced and remarried and has a concubine on the side, and he's got this animus against the church. So we have these these people who are professing their dutiful obedience to their parents in a disordered way, who at the same time are afraid to confront their parents with the truth on their deathbed to try and save their eternal souls, which is, it's a weird, it's a paradox.
Isn't that more like not to be nitpicking, isn't that more like the paradigm, not a paradigm? I mean, they're obsequious, they're afraid to tell their unholy fathers or less than perfectly holy fathers they're wrong in life. And so they reflect that in death, and therefore they're neglecting to do the most important thing they can do, right?
Sure, yeah, I guess there is, yeah, I think it's like, it's almost, you know how each virtue in Aristotle's Nicomachean Ethics, each virtue taken to the extreme actually becomes a vice, because the cardinal virtue is moderation. That holds the rest of the virtues kind of in check and allows them to function as they should. So an abundance of bravery, it's not bravery anymore, it becomes foolhardiness.
And rashness.
Right, and a lack of bravery is cowardice. And that's what it becomes, yeah. This over-obsequity to parents, not obedience, obsequity to parents, actually leads to children neglecting to care for their parents' souls, which are by far more important than caring for the body.
Here's what I think's going on. I think it's, you know, pardon a little bit of armchair psychology, but I think it's reasonably obvious. The majority of people have put their parents, their elderly, aging, infirm parents in homes, right? Adult children.
Let's get to that.
This creates a natural cycle of guilt, because it is natural to, unless your parent is hooked up to dialysis or life support, it's natural to have them there in your spare room.
Right.
This is the cycle of life. It creates natural guilt in faithful people, though I'd like to think faithful people perform their duty at a higher rate, in the, you know, moderately tepid faithful, and in the unfaithful alike. It's a natural drive, it's a natural virtue to take care of your aging parents. As Jesus said, it's not a supernatural virtue, it's a natural call. So it affects even secular people. This creates guilt, and so what they'd rather do than disrupt their life cycle and their life accoutrements and their natural patterns of life. And a lot of times they have a spouse, a wife that is no more supportive of having the parents live there than they are. They, in ways they can, they're obsequious to their parents, and they treat, you know, particularly the moderately faithful. They're like, oh, well, hey, the fourth commandment, right? So, you know, children, let's say we're dealing with three generations, a grandparent that's been put in a home, a grumpy old grandfather who has little or none of the faith. You know, let's say a 50-year-old couple who's got teenagers. Let's say they have a teenager that listens to this show, like, because it's so hip and whatnot. A lot of young people listen to this show, actually. And so the 15-year-old or 16-year-old listening to this show is like, you know, Grandpa, you got a divorce from Grandma. Like, this, before you expire, you need to deal with this. You need to go to confession. You need to live a continent lifestyle. If you have a new wife, you need to XYZ, right? Well, the moderately or tepid kind of bourgeois faithful, let's say, barely practicing middle generation, the 50-year-old parents, will be doing this. And I see it all around. I don't know how I've seen it so many times. There's, no, don't tell them that. That's bad. That's because they're substituting a kind of false discharging of a duty, you know, weird obedience that's no longer owed to their parents. You don't have to tell them everything they do is, you know, puppy dogs and ice cream. And they're substituting it for the fact that they know they ought to be caring. That's what I think is happening with the pop cycle.
We said this before, too, in regards to men who are addicted to pornography or who are not, you know, there for their families. You know, maybe they're workaholics or, like, pornaholics. And for some reason, they're either not being there for the wives or not being there for their kids in terms of material presence and formal presence in terms of, like, being actively there for their kids. They tend to have this guilt built up, so men like that tend to be overly obedient to their wives. You know, they tend to, like, they don't rule with the scepter of domestic and paternal authority because they know they've wronged their family in this other way, so they tend to bend over backwards to do their wives' behest, even when it's in a disordered way. And it's the same with parents or children who put their families in nursing homes. When like aged parents go to nursing homes, there's a guilt there and a rightful guilt. You shouldn't be sticking your family in a home. People should be kind of born at home and die at home. We live in a weird place where you're born in the hospital and you die in a nursing home. And don't get me wrong, I've had all my kids in the hospital. That's an aside, but. Since they have kicked aged parents out of the home and refused to care for them and not done their due diligence, there's this weird feeling of guilt that can manifest itself in a way where you refuse to challenge your parents. And part of the reason, by the way, people are sticking their parents in a home is because the wife's not home to take care of the parents when the husband is gone at work. Because she's got her own career. So
it's again, all related.
Thanks, feminism.
All of the devil's attack with feminism, modernism, enlightenment, Protestantism, it all syncs up.
Yeah,
absolutely. It's holistic.
We do need to touch, though, there is an ongoing duty. So of the three duties, love, reverence, and obedience, the only one that ends in majority is obedience. So all of this is something that you get, you know, the church, its moralists are all united on this point. That obedience ends once the age of the majority is attained, except in matters if you are going to be a 19 or 20-year-old living with your parents, they can make reasonable demands about what time you should be home so that it's not disruptive to family life. So they can still say, since it's their house, they can set rules for even adult kids if they're going to be living in their home so that it's not... The behavior of adult kids, their deportment, is not disruptive to family life. Here's what Trent says.
Bizarrely specific.
Yeah, no, they get into the weeds, the moralists. So here's what Trent says about the duty of respect, which is the duty of reverence. We also owe our parents other duties of respect, such as to supplicate God in their behalf, that they may lead prosperous and happy lives, beloved and esteemed by all who know them, and most pleasing in the sight of God and of the saints in heaven. Now, Tim's brought up, well, first, yeah, there's this overarching duty. When we speak of our parents, we are to speak as highly of them as is possible while still committed to truth, because the commandments don't conflict, right? So you can't, a lot of people, oftentimes, especially in the age of the morally bankrupt father, or the absconding father, or the morally bankrupt mother that we see in, like, especially post-sexual revolution, post-no-fault divorce America, and post-no-fault divorce the West in general, people have parents that weren't role models at all, and they think that they are being pious when they lie to everybody to extol these people who lived kind of deplorable lives. But they're doing it, since they're extolling these people, they think they're honoring their father and their mother. It's not honoring your father and your mother to transgress God's commandment not to lie. That's not right either. We have a duty to honor our father and our mother in word and to glorify them in so much as it's possible to do so without running afoul of precepts to truth. Because if you're running around, I mean, this is scandal in a way. If you're running around extolling the virtues and the merits of people who are obviously living bad lives, maybe they have a public divorce and are publicly not going to church, have renounced their Catholicism, and you're saying, oh, my parents are the best. You're actually scandalizing everyone who's hearing this, because you're telling them, like, these people are to be held up as role models, even though they might be faithless apostates. You can't do that.
But so, I mean, we've knocked down the misconception about obedience, adulthood obedience to one's elders. But you said, Dave, I'm responding to what you just said now, and I know the answer, but I want you to articulate it for viewers and listeners out there. You said that reverence, the duty to reverence, obtains.
Mm-hmm.
This is, in the age of absconding father, I have a two-part question.
Sure.
In the age of absconding family household fathers, which is also the age of absconding ecclesial fathers, right? Most of us feel abandoned by our bishops, abandoned by the Bishop of Rome. We were talking about this a couple shows ago. How does one reverence one's father, which the duty to do obtains? You just said, okay, but you can't lie. I think this is really important. I think this, we were dealing with this a couple shows ago, and people were, I don't know, maybe having questions. How does this work with regard to the Pope? Because they've heard me for a year and a half saying, this is bad, you know, and I've said it about probably 150 items, deeds or words of the current pontiff. Look, this is really wrong. You can't say that Jesus isn't part of the Trinity. So how does reverence obtain? Obedience is easy. You don't have to obey once you've obtained your majority.
And nor should you.
How do you reverence?
Because it disrupts family life if there's two heads, right?
Sure.
Jesus says when kingdom is split against kingdom, when kingdom is divided against kingdom, it falls. Cool. If you have a household with either grandfather or grandmother kind of acting as like superhead and husband as head, there's just bound to be conflict.
Sure, but that's the easy question.
Right.
And I see James Smith out there in our discussion. I thought your name was Janet Smith. I was like, oh, cool. We have Janet Smith. And it's just as good to have James, but I thought we had Professor Janet Smith from the Immaculate Heart Seminary.
Who do you think we are?
I've seen some pretty... I mean, James is dope, whoever you are, bud. But I've seen some pretty cool big names in Catholicism in our chair room. Nevertheless, you just answered the easy part of the question. We already knocked down that bowling pin.
Right.
How does reverence obtain with the household father and with ecclesial fathers that don't really, on a natural law basis, merit any reverence?
So Jonet actually treats this. Herbert Jonet, one of the preeminent moral theologians, especially in the pre-conciliar age, was widely considered like the gold standard. Priests would have his little book in the confessional with them. He actually treats part of this. For good reason. I think, let's see here. For good reason, you are allowed to not have any kind of relationship with your parent. And one of the examples given is if they're like a criminal or something like that, or they're living this overtly immoral life. You can revere your parents. You do not run afoul of the commandment to reverence or to honor your parents and that built-in plank of reverencing your parents, should you have good reason to not affiliate with your parents in whatever that may be, that does not run afoul of reverencing parents. So if you have a parent that's giving scandal or who is just cantankerous and ornery and is a
source... Hits you with their cane every time you see him.
Conflict all around. You know, they're a source of division. Maybe it's hurting your family, your family of origin. Because, again, we haven't gone into this yet. But once you get married or you split, you're in your vocation, you have cleaved. So... And now your love doesn't go up. Like in the Trinity, the love comes down from the Father to the offspring, right? The love of the Father goes down to the Son. A lot of parents, there's this failure to cleave so that their attention and their loyalties and duties are split in their minds between sending them upwards back to like the grandparent generation and versus downwards to kids. And there, I don't have my other moral theology handbook in front of me, but the duties of parents are actually properly oriented downwards. That is the preeminent way that parents ought to love, is in a downward way towards their children. Once you cleave, well, there's always a duty to love, again, and reverence your father and your mother. In so far as those are nuanced terms, the duty is truly for your new vocation. Your love, the most of your love, the lion's share of your love goes downwards. So, Tim, to answer your question, what people say, here's Jonet, sins against filial reverence are committed by internal contempt, offensive speech, disdainful deportment, striking blows. But at the same time, one may have good reason for not desiring to associate with his parents, provided, of course, that he provides for their necessary support.
Yeah, so it boils down to what I was saying. I mean, because we're not, you don't identify how to discharge a duty or an obligation by saying what would violate it. That'd be the negative answer to the question. The positive answer to the question is, what must I do to discharge this duty? Obedience, I no longer have to obey my parents. And that makes sense. But everyone's confused by, and it's deeply personal, isn't it? Like, everyone's running around, not everyone, many, many Catholics are running around in the crisis era of fatherhood, feeling with their household fathers, he's like a secular humanist, right? What do I do? And maybe he comes to Mass, maybe he doesn't, but his point of view is completely secular humanist. That's the devil's, according to Sister Lucy of Fatima, this is the final attack of Satan on the world. We're somewhere near the 11th hour. And fathers no longer lead their family. The fathers are no longer leading the church. We are the age of parish orphans. We were thinking of calling this show, by the way, when we were working it up in the fall, the parish orphans, right? Because many people feel abandoned by household fathers and mothers and abandoned by ecclesial fathers. So let's get that out there and say this is the more personalist, I think that's a JP2 word, I don't often use it, the more personalist unpacking of Benedict XVI's expression that this is the crisis of father. But so, I mean, so basically, what must you do if you're an adult? Let's say you're 35, you can't get together because it's too divisive with your parents. They're not Catholic. You're trying to raise your kids in the faith, and your adult parents are, you know, they wear Rolling Stones shirts and they make fun of the Catholic Church every time you come over. You say, look, this is the source and the summit of our life, my family life with my kids and my wife. I'm not going to be around you. So it does feel counterintuitive, right? To say, well, I'm still reverencing my parents, even though I tell my kids we're not going over to grandma and grandpa's because they're saying wicked things and we can't be around them due to their wickedness.
Sure. I would say, you know, that's the total abstaining from seeing someone is like the nuclear option. So to do that imprudently, like just because...
But how do you do it prudently?
Right. Right. So to do it imprudently obviously is wrong. It would be a sin to cut yourself off from your parents unless there was really good reason to do so. How do you do it prudently? I mean, it's a question of prudence. It's a tough answer, right? Because prudential these things that teeter on the line of a prudential judgment call are by nature, of course, that's why a lot of times you say leave it to prudence, is because sometimes you can't articulate it, but you know it when you see it. It's you've got to make the, it's almost how the church does excommunication, right? There's mortal sins, and then there's like excommunication worthy, like serious mortal sins that cry up to heaven for vengeance. I'm not.
But categorically, I mean, I think it boils down to Thomas Aquinas' answer, which you always have to be providing for, even in the nuclear option where you've sort of disrupted the quotidian rapport between you and your grown-up parent, grown-up kid and grown-up parent. You must always let them know, okay, unless they're a physical danger to you being there, they have a welcome room at your house, even if your elderly father is the most cantankerous old coot known to man, right? You gotta provide for them. You have to say, look, if you need me, I'm here. I don't want to talk to you when you're here. I don't want to talk to you about faith or really anything if you're going to be this negative, but you have a spot here. That's how you, I think that's it.
Right.
That's how I've worked.
Well, that's like the ultimate, you know, if nothing, if you cannot in any way show outwardly the reverence in word, deed, and sign, because once again, there is this duty to do reverence in word, deed, and sign. It has to be affective, meaning you feel it insofar as it's possible for a just man to feel reverence for another person. And you also act on that and let the reverence that is in your heart spill out into your actual actions, right?
Okay, So how do you do it then? What's the analogy? I think it's a natural built-in analogy. How do you do it for church men? You know, we're not responsible for, you know, putting our bishop up in our home. But what if you have one of those bishops? You know, I'm not saying I do. We live under a new bishop that everyone's very hopeful about. But what if you live under one of those bishops, very commonly, who is formally or informally run into a place of apostasy and is no longer teaching the faith? How do you reverence?
Well, sure. The Catechism of Trent actually covers this, and it says, oh, the apostle teaches that they are entitled to obedience. Obey your prelates and be subject to them, for they watch as being to render an account of your souls. Nay more, Christ the Lord commands obedience, even to wicked pastors. Upon the chair of Moses have sitten the scribes and Pharisees all things. Therefore, whatsoever they shall say to you, observe and do. But not according to the works do ye not, for they say and do not. So even if you have a bishop who is not being a faithful steward, you have a duty to obey him insofar as he's giving lawful commandments under the color of his office, even though he's not himself doing as he preaches. Now, but if he's saying something doctrinally errant, then of course our highest duty of honor would go to Christ himself, who is supreme priest of our church, right? Who is the supreme head of the church. So ultimately, if a bishop is teaching doctrinally things that are heretical, then there's no duty to give assent to that because it would undercut what Christ himself teaches. And our highest duty, of course, goes to Christ. And when there's a conflict of duties, you revert back to the highest duty that's owed.
Yeah. But I mean, like, this is also misleading. Your bishop can't tell you, hey, you need to sell your house and move to Hawaii.
No, he doesn't have temporal authority like that.
Well, so that's the kind of obedience we're talking about with fatherly, obedience that no longer is owed after you're 18. So we're talking about a kind of canonical obedience. You know, your bishop can say, you know, January 1st, is a holy day of obligation in our diocese that either will be rolled into the previous Sunday or not. He has that. It's a really limited kind of obedience, canonically. Doctrinally, what people are wondering is like, hey, you know, my bishop says don't distribute to people that want to receive on the knees, even though there's a 1969 letter forever preserving that right of the faithful to receive on their knees by Paul VI. I guess I was asking, how do you reverence a bishop that's saying things, which so many of them are, they're out there saying things like, you know, they're making little rules of thumb that go against the perennial teachings of the church, the praxis of even post-Vatican II disciplines that are supposed to be available to rigids, like the one I mentioned, and they're really just harassing you and being a kind of hostile witness to the faith. How do we reverence them? I mean, just put it in real terms.
It's a tougher question, of course. In some of these, when we get down to the nitty-gritty of it, the answers are really quite hard. With a bishop who's intent on undercutting, like, the true faith, of course, again, you adhere to the deposit of faith. You don't become un-Catholic because you have an unfaithful steward. This duty of reverence, this is treated in the catechism. The duty of honoring pastors and civil authorities is treated under the fourth commandment. So there's crossover. The duties of love, reverence, and obedience all cross over, not just, you know, from parents to both civil authorities and ecclesial authorities. So I would say it's a similar answer in that we give reverence to these people insofar as it's possible, affectively and effectively, in emotion and in actual act, where it's possible. But that doesn't mean lying and saying that Cardinal Supich is doing a great job for the church in terms of his stances. You don't have to ever lie. And as a matter of fact, the part of love means being open to criticizing where people err, right? That's why I think in the Catholic blogosphere and in the Catholic, like, Twitter sphere and even podcasting world, there's a great service out there being done when people, out of a sense of filial piety, are reaching out and saying, you've erred here, bishops, and we're calling them back to repentance in a way. It's not because we're trying to chastise them as a bad son would turn up his nose at his father and revile his father, right? It's we're calling these people back to repentance, into communion with the faith, just like a good, you know, even a good minor child, if he sees his parents living a seriously sinful life and the minor child has the intellectual wherewithal, he is able to call his parents to repentance in this gentle and, you know, deferent way of doing it.
Yeah. No, people know that's my answer from having watched a bunch of these shows on errant bishops and an errant bishop of Rome. It's like, I think the only answer I could give, sort of like that pertaining to an errant household father, the only way to really reverence them, to revere them, aside from the exception, which doesn't hold, the analogy breaks down between a household and ecclesial father with regard to, I put my household father up, even if he's a, you know, he's an old so-and-so, is correction, right? I mean, that's, and if I'm wrong, then heaven help me, because I've done a fair amount of sort of armchair correction here. Some people out there, on the traditional right, and many people on the, you know, national Catholic distorter left in the Catholic world say, oh, this is like a grift. You're making a kind of, they're especially saying this about me and Marshall there in last February, March, April, when every show was on a correction because so much was happening. You're making a grift or kind of a cottage industry out of being a layperson correcting the bishop. Well, what else do you want us to do, man? I mean, that's at a certain point, it's like this, everyone wrap your heads around it. This is the age of absconding fathers in both senses at all levels of society, ecclesially, familially. And it is the greatest, most potent attack that the devil could make on humanity. Because what's the unit of society? Is it the individual, like they started saying in the Enlightenment? No, it's the family. Is the single cell, the building block of society. Fathers have left us. We're all parish orphans to one extent or another. You know, even if you're one of the 1 in 100 that's got a father that really taught you what you needed to know, Jesse Romero talks about the things his father taught him, and I think he's passing on to his kids. You're 1 in 100, or maybe 1 in 50, but that doesn't guarantee you a good bishop.
Right.
So, you correct. I think that's it. Now, I mean, can we talk about the way that this trickles down? It's like trickle-down economics to the brothers, siblings, brothers and sisters.
So let me just get in one thing real fast. The Bible actually speaks about this. I think it's New Testament. I want to say maybe in Timothy, but don't quote me on that. When you are to correct a prelate or an elder, it says do so basically in a spirit of meekness and not as like chastisement, but do so as essentially a son corrects a father. Do so, if we're going to correct an errant prelate, we should do so while still being rightly deferent to them and their position of authority within the church. So I think that's important. So that has to do not so much with what you say, but the manner in which you say it. As far as you're talking about siblings, Tim, like how to deal with errant siblings or just to deal with...
Yeah, I'm hearing our buffering is really bad. Sorry, I just turned off my phone.
Okay, yeah, I mean, so
there's the great novelist of all time by pretty much everyone's measures, Fyodor Dostoevsky. I talked about him a fair amount from time to time on TNT. He was influenced by, of course, he's Russian Orthodox thinker, had mostly contempt toward the Catholic Church, even though we're not as different as he sometimes sounded. But he was influenced by this mystical Russian Orthodox thinker named Soloviev, who is very, very interesting and who had a lot of love for the Catholic Church. Soloviev, and I even think this was repeated with a thinker named Bulgakov during Vatican I, would regularly say that here's the problem with our Orthodox Church, and this made some, you know, Dostoevsky's writing reflects some love for the Catholic. Say, look, we're the Orthodox. We don't have the same kind of centralizing force of Papa that the Roman Catholic Church has. And there are, whatever, 14 autocephalous Orthodox churches. We saw this a couple years ago and a couple years before that, I think 2014 and then 2016. You try to get together all the sons, and the sons cannot gather themselves. Soloviev said, without Papa to gather the sons, the meeting will always break down. People always leave early. The sons need their father to gather them. And Soloviev, and I think Bulgakov, were saying this as a kind of self-critique of their fatherless Orthodox Church.
And we just saw this when they tried to call the Pan-Orthodox like Synod or Pan-Orthodox Council in, 2015, 2014? And they couldn't get it together because you have to have a father.
Right.
A household without a father is doomed to infighting, factiousness, and general just lawlessness and movement in all directions. You have to have a father as the principle around which a family can cohere.
Right. So, given that we've already kind of laid the foundation for 40 minutes about, A, we live in the age of absconding fathers. Most fathers are not doing their duties. B, we can't really even run to our ecclesial fathers because half the time they're either busy or in a low-key state of apostasy. So we have no fathers. Then it just means, C, conclusion, wow, there's going to be a lot of infighting between adult siblings.
Right.
Adults. I mean, that's what we have. Think about the Soloviev quote. Let's say you and your adult siblings, let's say you got three or four, let's say you have an old Fyodor Karamazov father, and let's say you and your brothers Karamazov, let's say instead of being Alyosha, Ivan and Dmitry, you're a bunch of Alyoshas, you're all good, you're all holy, and you say there are three Alyoshas instead of having two kind of unholy brothers, and you want to just say, forget Fyodor, our father, he's bad, he's an old, you know, old lecherous ruin. Let's just get together and keep the family tight. If these theological implications are right, if Soloviev's intuition was spot on, then it's going to be hard to do even if you have three Alyoshas.
Right, because problems inevitably creep up, and this is one of the ways that you can have this patriarch, like a family patriarch, and that doesn't mean he's giving orders to people who have cleaved. That's not what, like, this notion of, like, the wizened old grandfather sitting in his easy chair and doling out tidbits of wisdom for the next generations really means. But what it does mean is if there is a dispute in the family, and there is factiousness taking place, then the father, as part of his duty, this patriarch, I guess it would be grandfather possibly in this case, as part of his duties, should be there almost as an arbiter and a judge and a consigliere to his sons, to his daughters, to help settle these disputes. He should continue taking an ongoing interest in the health of his family. And since there should be inculcated in all families a sense of filial piety and reverence, then if there were to be disputes between siblings or, you know, wives in a family, like the wives of children, then all can look to this figure of wisdom, this patriarch, and kind of solicit his non-binding, but still well-owed advice, right? And that can be his role in maintaining family unity, is to be a dispensary of advice and an arbiter of conflict, right? What do you think?
Well, I mean, in the ordinary court, but I mean, maybe prior to this age, but the premise is sort of like, well, that's sort of how it's supposed to go. What's ideally the ideal?
Right.
Yeah, but we're talking about the problematic when we have deviated as a society, you know, 19 of 20 of us, 49 out of 50, whatever, so far from the ideal. Now we're saying, okay, well, we're basically Soloviev's fatherless family. You know, that's at least the problem that we're dealing with. Right. And the resultant squabbling even among, okay, that would be great. Yeah, if you have an old father, you don't have to obey him. But if he's old and holy, you can use him like a consigliere and seek his advice and at least kind of make him the tiebreaker, something like that. That's not obedience.
Like you're Brady right. Bunch family court, right? Except Mike Brady could do what he wants because he's a baller.
You don't really want him to do what he wants, though, because he was
baller
in all the wrong ways. As it turns out, whatever that guy's name was, the actor.
That crushed me, by the way. That just destroyed my spirits. I went on a Wikipedia journey one time about the Brady Bunch and what ended up happening to them. And when I realized Mike Brady and Marsha Brady's fates in life, I've got to say I was depressed for a few days.
Yeah, well, it's strangely apropos of the time. I mean, it was this crazy 70s, and they were both leading bad lives. And Mike Brady was an absconding father in real life, contrary to what we saw on the screen. But, I mean, so here's the thing. We're at the point in the show where I'd like to, just in closing, pitch some solutions.
Well, we got one more thing. We got to get, quickly, duties of parents towards their children, too. Because there is some, you know, corresponding duties of parents are where these get overlooked, and parents are demanding under the color of the fourth commandment this absolute godlike worshipfulness on the part of their children, and they're not realizing it binds them too. Sorry, I didn't mean to jump in. I just wanted to put that out there.
I mean, that's probably worth its own show, but
sure.
All I was saying is there. Luckily, here we're not just left to our own prudential judgments. If you are a family full of, I think this is a lot of our listeners and viewers, that's why it's relevant. If you are a family full of maybe kind of three Alyoshas, the good brother, without, you know, with a some degree of Fyodor father, you know, that he's not interested in Catholicism, to say the least, or even Orthodoxy, to say the least, you can consult the words of our Lord in the Gospel, Matthew's Gospel, chapter 18, verse 15. Remember, Matthew's writing to the Jews of his time. The Jews are very interested in family hierarchy. And so the question was, what to do if your brother offends you, right? And the Jews were more patriarchal, meaning the father's advice would have been a little bit more binding, whatever. Jesus still gives advice that says, okay, if you're two adult brothers and you're squabbling and you're genuinely offended, take this three-step approach. And there's nothing proverbial or, you know, it's not symbolic. Jesus is being specific and literal. In Matthew chapter 18, verse 15, if your brother offends you, and let's say your father is not available for as an advice giver, first you go tell him. You just say, look. And I feel like this is happening all around because of the foundation that we laid with family structures being all but ruined. So first go tell your brother, right? You go tell him, look, you offended me. Give him the opportunity because he's not perfectly self-aware. You hurt my feelings. You probably, a lot of times, you're not going to be heard out. Then bring one or two other trusted members of the family maybe along. And hopefully he'll hear you then. You're kind of increasing incrementally the leverage you're applying to help him out because no one's perfect at making apologies. So bring a couple others along. And finally, bring the whole church, which means maybe a priest, maybe a representative of the church. We're using synecdoche here, like saying the White House said this morning that some representative of the church. And if he won't hear you, still, Jesus does, whether you like it or you lump it, again, we're not arguing for this. It is an option to say, to treat him like a publican, right? To treat him like a tax collector, just say, okay, well, I can't be around you. This is a viable option.
St. Paul does this, you see, in 1 Corinthians and then 2 Corinthians, where somebody is living outside the precepts of the church in this grave way, you know, living with his father's wife. So, you know, very scandalous activity. And St. Paul says, turn him over to the devil then. And then in 2 Corinthians, I believe the man comes back and they're rejoicing that, you know, excommunication. It's this ecclesial remedy, and people are like, oh, that's just ecclesial, but it's based in, it's very natural. If somebody's living outside the precepts of decency, they don't just deserve the relationship with either the church, the collective of the church and the individuals therein, or with you as an individual. There's no duty to ever have a relationship with any human being except for Jesus Christ. Not a personal relationship with any human being except for Jesus Christ, and of course being in communion with the church.
Well, your kids, as they're growing up.
Well, of course, but
that's part of the downward duty of parents.
Sure, no.
No other adult. There's no other human adult besides Jesus that you're called to a personal relationship with that's unbreakable.
So on that note, let me just cover quickly, and this might deserve its own show. I think Tim might be right. The duty of parents towards their children. Let's do it real fast. The primary duty of parents to their children is to love them. All the other parental duties are steeped in this fundamental duty of love. And love, because there's a lot of hard cases out there that want to say, oh, well, I show my kids tough love and just, you know, do it through discipline. No, love has to be both affective and effective. So you must harbor it in your heart. You have to have goodwill towards your children, to love your children truly and to feel that in your heart. And it also comes out indeed. And discipline is indeed something that is the product of love. So we have, under this commandment, the Catechism of Trent says three things to be avoided by parents. In the first place, they are not by words or actions to exercise too much harshness towards their children. This is the instruction of St. Paul in his epistle to the Colossians. Fathers, he says, provoke not your children to anger, lest they be discouraged, for there is danger that the spirit of the child may be broken. Then, let's see here. Secondly, should a fault be committed which requires reproof and chastisement, the parent should not, on the other hand, by undue indulgence, overlook its correction. So there is this duty to discipline, and there is this spirit of leniency out there. You see a lot of people, again, even in the church, like, oh, I don't spank my kids, that's evil. No, if you spare the rod, you spoil the child. He who spares the rod hates his child, the Bible tells us. You've got to discipline your kids. You have to be a disciplinarian. You can't not spank your kids. The Bible says to bow their heads when they're young, so they're not a terror to you when they're older. And then thirdly, to avoid what is most shameful in the instruction and education of children, let them not propose to themselves aims that are unworthy. And I think, Tim, you're going to have a lot to say on this. I know me and you have talked about this privately. Many there are whose sole concern is to leave. And let me just interrupt myself here to say, I think I might see in our culture now, I think this might be the predominant problem with parents, or at least it affects a plurality of families, and it's the prosperity gospel. Many are there whose sole concern is to leave their children wealth, riches, and an ample and splendid fortune, who encourage them not to piety and religion or to honorable employment, but to avarice and an increase of wealth, and who, provided their children are rich and wealthy, are regardless of their good name and eternal salvation. Can anything more shameful be thought or expressed of such parents? It is true to say that instead of bequeathing wealth to their children, they leave them rather their own wickedness and crimes for an inheritance, and instead of conducting them to heaven, lead them to the eternal torments of hell.
Yeah, this kind of reflects the Protestantization of society, or the prosperity gospel, the Protestant work ethic, where parents tend to talk as if, in our society, even Christian parents, maybe especially Christian parents, talk as if a kid doesn't grow up and make a lot of money, then he is a failure. It's like, no, if a kid grows up without holiness, then the kid himself's a failure, and the parents themselves are failures. St. John Vianney says, if your kids go to hell, don't worry, you'll probably be there to meet them.
Huh.
St. Mother Teresa says, we are all called to holiness, not success. Some saints will be successful financially, but most probably won't. Remember the Holy Family, one of my very favorite saints, he should be one of your top three or four, St. Joseph, was not a rich man. So the prosperity gospel is nonsense. And so much of us get this from our parents. Oh, my dad was a great provider. Now, he wasn't the best at, he didn't really teach me anything about the faith, but he was a great provider. It's like, that's just materialism, right?
Great father. Didn't teach me anything about the faith, but we had at least our own bedrooms.
We had three cars, and they were all fancy. It's like, that we need to recognize. And I mean, people out there wrongly call me, some of my Twitter rivals call me a libertarian, which I'm not, but I am a defender of the right kinds of market capitalism. But I am, so I'm the opposite extreme here. Everyone knows, market capitalism does not always deliver this kind of Protestant prosperity gospel. The wrong sense of market capitalism is Protestant, and it tends to be materialistic. And this comes from, really, according to Max Weber, I talk about this in two of the three books I've now written, it's a kind of pop psych substitution in the Protestant mind, because they got rid of family as a sacrament, matrimony as a sacrament, they got rid of all the sacraments except one, or in some cases three, but matrimony is just a worldly thing, according to Luther and the Lutherans. Calvin accepted it. It's not a sacrament, meaning a path to heaven. And it's basically, whereas what I do, a sacramental Christian, what Dave does, I go to work just to pave the way for my vocation. My vocation is my wife and kids, getting them to heaven, along with myself. What the Protestants started doing is, since, there's no such thing as a vocation in your family anymore because it's not a sacrament, they started treating, according to Max Weber, labor as the real kind of daily sacrament that's purifying and edifying and sacralizing. So you can see, Protestant families will have, a couple kids or whatever, that kind of justifies needing to work hard and needing that wealth. But then you run into the problem, which is widespread in English-speaking nations, of, guys kind of falling in love with working extra hours, not being there at home. Like, okay, you got to call at the end of the day. Like Theoden of Rohan says, a good soldier arrives after a three-day journey with strength enough to fight. A man can't get home from work too tired to begin his real vocation. This is just kind of an unimportant, indispensable element of your vocation as a man. We're charged with one of the curses of Adam. We have to work during the day, but you got to, like Théoden of Rohan says, you got to arrive home with strength enough and energy enough to be a good teacher, fatherly lover. You got to, you know, offer quizzical insight. What'd you learn at school today? What, you know, guide the prayers. You cannot be in the background. The father of the household is a big duty. And that's why all men are called the leadership.
I actually spoke about this in our book too, in the feminism book. This is why it's also so insidious and diabolical when men get home and they have to be part-time mothers when they get home. So they have to get home and start changing diapers and doing the kitchen. It's insidious because during their part-time mothering, right, after their full-time job, that actually takes away from those special fatherly things that he can do for the household and that will leave a lasting impression on forming the kids. So when the father gets home and there's this hyper-egalitarian milieu that pervades the house and he has to get home and make a pretense and they're cooking in the kitchen all together and then they're doing dishes all together, that precludes the father from going out in the cool evening Americana breezes and playing ball with his son and teaching his son how to throw a proper spiral or to hit a heavy bag properly or to be there with his daughter and just chatting with her or, you know, teaching her how to like rollerblade or fixing things in the house and showing his son how to work with his hands or his daughter about some aspect of home economics. It disrupts and destroys that aspect of home life. And people are like, well, Dave's saying it's intrinsically evil to do the dishes. No. You know me, Tim. You've probably seen me, you know, around doing laundry ever if Rebecca is, like, laid up or something. My wife is laid up or sick or when she's had a baby and she can't do her duties, her motherly duties because of circumstances of life. You know, she's off her feet because she's late in pregnancy. Then I'll take over. But those are the exception to the rule, and the rule shouldn't swallow, or the exception shouldn't swallow the rule. And in most people's houses I visit, it's the husband comes home from a full day's work and instead of doing his fatherly and husbandly duties around the house, he's stuck picking up the matronly duties. And it turns my stomach for that reason. Not because there's just something evil about a man doing housework. No, we all do it when necessity calls for it. It's something evil about him doing that to the exclusion of his proper duties as husband and father, which are different from those of wives. Sorry. Okay. So,
yeah.
That said, I wanted to get one thing in. There,
we gotta wrap up.
Right. Here. We're up against the clock, but this duty to love one's children manifests in two ways for parents, right? Aside from being affective and effective love, that means you can't like root it to do badly in life, and you also have to show them actual tenderness and affection, hug them, tell them you love them. But that also manifests itself in education. So the education of your children, you love them, right? And true love means caring for someone's final end. It doesn't mean wanting them to like just do whatever they want. You know, you hear this abused in the context of gay marriage, like, oh, I love my friend and he's gay, so why doesn't he deserve to be happy? Well, because that's an act of hatred. True love means wanting someone to get to heaven. So educating your kids for heaven, so educating them in the faith is one of the duties that's rooted in love. And then providing for their life, health, and well-being. Now, one other thing, duties of parents in the Catechism of the Catholic Church in paragraph 2223 covers something that's super, super important because it is kind of the mechanism by which family integrity is held intact. Because if you have a king who does whatever he wants with impunity, whether it's a father or a mother, because when you're a child, for all intents and purposes, they're your king and queen of the household. If they just do whatever they want with impunity, what happens? That there's dissension in the kingdom. And it's bad example, for one, but there's dissension in the kingdom, and then when the family grows up, it splits apart. So the Catechism of the Catholic Church talks about the duty of parents to apologize for wrongdoing to their family. Because you hear the fourth commandment abused, right, Tim? Maybe you can end on this. you hear the fourth commandment abused so that people who are culpable, elders who are culpable, say, you have to put up with my crap. You have to put up with all of the things I've done to you. And you can't call me on it. You can't come to me as a son and beseech me and say, I need an apology for this before we can go on and have a relationship. You can't do that because you owe me honor. Honor thy father and thy mother. You have to be obsequious to me and take all of the crap that I can dole out without you know, calling me on it. And that's wrong. Here's the catechism on the duty to apologize. Parents have a grave responsibility to give good example to their children. By knowing how to acknowledge their own failings to their children, parents will be better able to guide and correct them. You have to know how to acknowledge your own failings to your kid. Tim, what say you?
Yeah, I mean, it's part of living in the sacraments, right? There's a confession is practiced daily in a lower, you know, not quite sacramental way by apologizing to whomever you offend. And of course, it's practiced hopefully weekly or biweekly or whatever. And if you are dealing with the kind of old, you know, codger that had left his religion or never had religion, that's trying to be the head of a household without living in the sacraments, it's simply not going to be possible to maintain relations. Parents have to, simply have to, they have to say sorry before the kids do. So often in the, I think what you read speaks for itself, that, you know, oftentimes parents will make one child apologize to the other for hitting them, but the kids never hear the dad apologize to them or the mother if he was grumpy getting home from work. That's just, he's dealt with like an autocrat. All of this has spelled ruin for the family. I mean, that's what we're dealing with. That's why we're doing a show today. I saw a couple people wondering whether or not we're from a divorced household, which I think is part of the symptom of the problem. If you hear people talking this way, you assume we're automatically on the kind of bifurcated structure. It's 50-50. One in two of us are from divorced households. No, we're from a household with parents that are together, got together young, and always had a strong marriage. So that's not the only reason or way that this stuff can come up. It's not. It's a divorce. That's where we have to stop thinking in that. I forget the term you use, the bifurcated structure,
like bimodal.
Bimodal, yeah, the bimodal distribution. It's not just the 50% of households that are divorced that are troubled by all this stuff. It's the other 50% of the households, which maybe the mother and the husband and wife have a really strong bond. But
because pride, right?
Because of pride. Yeah, a lot of people just know, okay, this is total ruin. Divorce is total ruin. But among the 50% of households that have a mother and father who are undivorced, who remain together, it's still a very small portion where all of the time-tested, Jesus-delivered Christian norms of family living are being, not perfectly, but even just daily observed. And this leads to ruin even in those households that are together, you know, with a large portion of them.
You know, there's a weird thing that happens too with the culture being so perverse and so gross and divorce being so pervasive, like one out of two marriages. It gives a sense of moral superiority to people who just do the basic and don't like mortally sin by getting a divorce. So
right.
People, couples who don't get a divorce, this sense of pride can sink in because the culture is so bankrupt. So by just doing this basic duty of keeping the family intact, they think that by virtue of that, they're like living saints. That don't have, maybe their parents got a divorce, and therefore they didn't, so they think their marriage is impeccable, and the way they're raising their kids is impeccable, so they owe no apologies.
Right.
No apology is owed because you didn't screw it up royally, but you can still totally ruin your own family, right, without going nuclear and getting the divorce.
Right. No, I think that's really important, and it's probably extra important for the kind of people that are out there listening to Catholic podcasts and looking for Catholic content online, because they know, you know, okay, I'm going to avoid the divorce. You can't do that, right? That's a status sin. That you just basically, if I get remarried, it's automatic life status, mortal sin, hell, all the things. So yeah, people out there are smarter than that, that are listening to this. But what you guys and me and you and all of us need to be ever mindful of is the idea that, yeah, the standards are so low now, we should not run into self-aggrandization just because we're not divorced. That's, divorce is for, is such a loss, it's such a big loss, such a, I mean, like in the sense of, you know, sports. I mean, that's just the ultimate loss. It is the family, the household just splitting in half and everything being destroyed in its wake.
And we're called to perfection, right? We're not called to,
right.
You know, we're not judged at the end of our lives at our individual judgments, right? In with comparison to the rest of the messed up world. We're judged in comparison to the standard of perfection, not having any mortal sins that are unconfessed.
Joseph and Mary's marriage, that's the standard we're judged on.
Right.
Did you have that kind of marriage? Were you this kind of selfless men? Were you, I mean, Joseph, the most chaste spouse, was called to a lifetime of chastity. I mean, look at the great honor he had. He was the terror of demons. He was the ultimate stepfather to our Lord. Mary was the ultimate in gentleness, never reproving, never reproaching, never yelling at her husband. You know, they were the ultimate standard. That's really high bar. We don't revere the Holy Family just because they didn't get a divorce. So avoid this easy pitfall, people. There can be near ruin, and I think it's very widespread, even in the non-divorced household. I think that really is a symptom of the problem. Most of the problems we talked about in today's show, and we really need to end here because we're over an hour 15. Most of the problems in today's show are applicable, or maybe even especially applicable, I'd have to think about it, in the non-divorced household.
Right. Right? We're not talking about just like the absolute catastrophe of familial dissociation. We're right. Talking about within normal, like quasi-functional families. The divorce show, that needs to be a whole other thing, because exactly. That's, you know, that's FUBAR, if I may, in a whole, it's a totally different level. We're talking about within families that are still in name functional.
Yeah. Amen. But people, without Papa being, not just living in another household, that's divorce, without Papa being an active participant in the sacraments and being an active, loving father after he gets home from work, which is relatively unimportant compared to his duties getting home from work, without him doing that most of the days of the family's life, there's going to be a weird distortion in the adult relation rapport between the adult children and him later.
And
going
accountability.
To overcompensate. Yeah, and accountability.
A good leader must be accountable. There must be parental apologies. It not only for example, because you were talking about how the father or mother affect the relations between the siblings, right? They're younger, the kids, and how they're going to relate to one another in adulthood. If your parents don't apologize, you're not going to know how to apologize. Parents model how to apologize, but good rulers know how to be accountable to their people, and everybody messes up. I apologize to my kids a couple times a week at least, not because I'm holy or humble or anything like that, quite the opposite, because, you know, everybody messes up, me most of all. And when you mess up as a father or mother, if you don't want your kids to think that this is the normal behavior, where you went wrong, where you erred, if you don't apologize for what you've done, they're going to think your errors are right.
You preserve your average. If you're a nice father and you apologize when you screw up, what you're doing is you're preserving your average in their view. You're relatively favorable average. Your relatively virtuous disposition. If you don't apologize, this isn't just fathers to sons. This is brother to brother or husband to wife. If you're like, no, I didn't do something wrong there, it's like, okay, I guess you're an a-hole.
And that doesn't change anyone's mind either, right? Because when you're a victim of some kind of abuse or grievance, like, no one's going to tell you, oh, you don't deserve an apology, I was right anyway. If someone steals my wallet, they're not going to be like, you don't deserve an apology, I had a right to your wallet. And then I'm going to be like, well, gee, George, okay. No, that's not how it works. I'm just going to be like, not only won't you won't repent,
you're recalcitrant, you're obdurate.
Right. Not only are you a jerk, but you're also an unrepentant jerk. When you apologize, it actually makes people think higher of you. But when you apologize to your kids, that's part. There's a principle at stake. It's not just the practical effect that Tim was talking about, although that's very much at play. The principle is when you mess up, you apologize. And the people who are, Christ says it, right? The greatest in the kingdom of God is going to be he who serves most here. So as a father, as the head of your household, instead of claiming like the best, most tasty piece of meat for yourself at dinner, you should give it up. You should be most accountable. You should apologize the most if you're going to be a good father.
Yeah. I'm father to six. Dave's father to five. And yeah, we're trying to live these things out. And of course, children must apologize to parents when they do wrong too. But no one thinks otherwise, particularly in traditional circles. Sometimes people have the misconception that parents should not apologize. It's treated of even in the Catholic literature.
So 2223 is the catechism paragraph. Look it up.
Yeah, everyone go see CCC, what, 2223?
Yep.
All right, well, so we got Matt Fratt on Friday. We'll probably have maybe Chris Plants on Wednesday. You guys have a great day. Thanks for sticking with us on a long show. And fathers out there, love your children. Mothers, love your children.
Thanks, guys.
Peace.